to start by asking you something you've probably never been asked, she began. Who is your favorite Disney character? Susan is the next Diane Sawyer, y'all. His answer, by the way, was Ariel. He said he would most like to marry Ariel, the Little Mermaid, who most definitely would be sporting a bikini in her dating profile pic. Now, mind you, up until Chris's arrival, I had been typing away on my laptop, jotting down all of Susan's pearls of wisdom. And no one batted an eye. But when Chris began talking, Susan's hired security quickly approached me and told me I couldn't type anything that they were saying during their conversation. Because Chris Soules was relaying state secrets to us, apparently. I slammed my laptop closed in a huff and just began taking notes with good old paper and pen, which Mr. Security Man didn't seem to mind. Nonetheless, Malls was rattled. She was worried that Susan's team would Google us and uncover that I was a journalist and Malls was a comedian who had been trolling the event all day on Twitter. In other words, that we were not there for the right reasons. Malls kept whispering, "Should we just go? Should we just go?" over and over again under her breath. As she later told me, she was paranoid that we'd be found out, escorted into the women's locker room, and given the shaming of a lifetime. Then we'd have to go outside, hang our heads woefully, and wait 11 minutes for an Uber in the suburbs. Fortunately, I was able to convince Malls to stay and turn my attention back to Chris and Susan. She had moved on from Disney characters to his dating preferences. "What do you find most appealing in a woman?" she inquired.
"Looks is important, obviously," he answered.
"Listen, ladies, looks," she said, nodding towards the faux eyelash station that had been set up for later in the day.
But really it's about personality and how you hold yourself," he continued. "If they have an aura of strength about them, I think that's something that's important to me. Someone who has been raised well, and you can just tell that they have a background of having a good heart."
He went on to contradict nearly everything Susan had been talking about all morning, saying how he wanted a woman who had a career and was able to put him in his place. He said he hated text messaging and preferred making telephone calls. Susan gasped. "Amazing! A guy who actually calls!"
"You don't fall in love through texts. If a guy's throwing texts, you need to hold him accountable and move on or don't respond until you get a phone call," Chris advised.
"This is a man's opinion," Susan said. After about 15 minutes, Chris's time with us had already come to a close, so Susan proposed a toast. "Here's to all the bastards you're never gonna miss and the hot guys you're gonna kiss." We toasted with champagne. I don't drink, but Mal said it tasted cheap. At this point, Susan disappeared with Chris, and we were subjected to a series of increasingly dark presentations. With no explanation, representatives from local charities came forward to talk about the work their organizations do. In theory, this was to encourage the seminar participants to embrace charity work because Susan had said earlier that men are attracted to philanthropic women. But I felt bad for the charity reps who could sense that their presence wasn't entirely welcomed by the guests. To make matters worse, those who had paid extra to take photos with Chris kept getting called out of the room in the middle of the presentations. Then came a young lady from a local beauty salon to tell us about how important proper brow shape was, that brows frame our face and are the window to our soul. We learned all about eyelash extensions, microblading, and permanent makeup. Oh, and then there was the doctor from the Laser Center of Maryland. He was brought in to tell us all about the services he can provide to women. Facial rejuvenation, laser-assisted liposuction, Botox, lip fillers. By this point, Malls and I were sinking into a deep depression. Susan returned, her cheeks red, as she told us she'd been taking shots upstairs with Chris. We decided to skip the rest of the plastic surgery presentation and duck out early. I requested an Uber. It took 11 minutes to arrive. Why I'm a fan. Patty Stanger.
It's very unusual for a show to last that long on the air at network level in the love space. And we still fall apart when we see the people cry in the car. The producers and I know why they're doing it. They haven't eaten. They've only drank alcohol. They haven't talked to their loved ones on the telephone. They haven't seen TV or read a book. They're sequestered, and you get ruthless. Some of them are there for the right reasons. It's not an absolute. Some of the girls say, I've tried everything, online dating, mixers, traveling, nothing has worked, this is my last resort. Who is better to fix me up than The Bachelor? But people need to remember that this is a TV show. Part of it's not real life. They cast for reasons. They're going to put in 4 or 5 people that the main person is attracted to, and the rest is going to be for drama and excitement, like the Corinnes of the world. People can meet on television, but it's in the execution. Chemistry rules the street, and that cannot be changed. Can a girl look at a guy who is an 8 and he becomes a 10 in her eyes? Yes, by the personality. He might be shorter, he might not be as rich, but there's something there. It's not that way for a guy. When The Bachelor comes along, he sees 25 women and knows right away who he's interested in. Men are like, oh, I could do her, and that's it. The rest I'm not going to touch. In the last generation, there have been more women graduating from college than men. When the market crashed, a lot of men who were super successful over 30 lost their money. If they didn't invest wisely and didn't buy real estate, they basically were crying in their soup. So with that being the case, the new generation of millennials are saying to themselves, I watched my parents suffer to make money to put me through college. They're miserable. They get divorced at 50. Quality of life is way more important to me. So maybe I won't make as much money, but I'll live a better life. Your generation is less materialistic. You don't really need the expensive car. With Elon Musk coming out with a $32,000 Tesla, you'll be fine. A Prius is an ambiguous car. Is he rich and environmental or just poor? This generation doesn't see the fairy tale of men rescuing them because they don't have the poster people. In my day, it was still Cinderella, but now the prince is dead and Cinderella knows she's gotta make it on her own. I think on the show, people want that because it's a fame game. It's a competition to win the crown like Miss America, and you're drunk and you're not eating because you're afraid you're gonna look fat on camera. And there's champagne throughout the entire day. Now you're in a room with 25 women and one fucking guy. And everyone's talking nonstop about who's going to get him and how they're going to get him. Because viewers love it when the guy gets on the knee and proposes. That's the money shot. The ratings prove you love it. We're talking Nielsen here. And you're still watching. Even cord cutters are watching. So they're doing something right. Chapter 12. Intoxicated by Happily Ever After. The moment I began considering writing a book about The Bachelor, I was hosting one of my weekly viewing parties. Nearly every Monday during batch season, read January through September, a bunch of young women congregate in my living room with bottles of rosé and a plethora of Trader Joe's snacks. Friends have long stopped inviting me to events on Monday nights, and my roommates gird themselves for a couple of hours of raucous discussion. It's almost always the highlight of my week. When the gatherings began, I barely knew most of the girls who came. In fact, some I communicated with only via Twitter. I'm sure that sounds sketchy, but you're talking to someone who thought her best friend in 1998 was a girl she met in an AOL chat room. In the years since, we've helped one another through breakups, sweated out at the gym together, and even gone on road trips across California. Sure, my colleagues still love to mock my batch nights, and plenty of people tell me they mute my Twitter feed while the show is on. But this seemingly trivial reality show has actually been responsible for some of the best moments in my young adult life. Which brings me back to that fateful batch night. It was a special one. We were welcoming our first guest from the show, JJ Lane, a contestant from Caitlin Bristow's season of The Bachelorette. He'd started following me on Twitter. A lot of batch folks do this, I think because they want proximity to someone in the media. And before long, he'd agreed to be our guest of honor at a viewing party. These days, we're quick to welcome members of Bachelor Nation into the fray, and we've also watched alongside notable fans like Allison Williams, Melanie Lynskey, and Laureen Scafaria. Living in LA and interviewing celebrities for a living doesn't hurt. When Lane showed up, he was totally awesome. Even though he'd been painted as the villain of the season, he was gracious and dishy, spilling lots of fun behind-the-scenes info with a group of ladies he'd just met. I remember sitting on my couch, thinking about how judgmental I'd been while watching him on the show. I started to wonder if most of the people on the show were as wildly different in real life, and if they had the kind of war stories Lane did. This was also, coincidentally, around the time that Lifetime was debuting a new show called Unreal. Created by Marty Noxon and Sarah Gertrude Shapiro, the latter of whom had worked as an actual producer on The Bachelor for many years, Unreal was a fictionalized version of The Bachelor. It depicted life behind the scenes on a reality dating show called Everlasting, where producers treated contestants like total shit in order to make juicy television. Because of Shapiro's background, the show got a lot of attention when it debuted, and strong critical reviews. Judging from the first four episodes of Unreal, the job of a reality producer is, however the participants may justify it, a grifter's game, read New Yorker critic Emily Nussbaum's 2015 review of the first season. It's a profession for people whose personality disorders make them adept at exploiting the personality disorders of others, who possess the compartmentalization skills of those shrinks who rubber-stamp torture techniques for the CIA. Eating disorders, daddy's death, and on-set date rape, it's all fodder for the story, or something to be covered up. Like a slaughterhouse exposé, Unreal is designed as an audience intervention, forcing viewers to taste the cruelty in their reality TV bacon. The fact that the show itself tastes like bacon, at once sweet and salty, greasy, and irresistible, is no accident. In his review in the New York Times, John Caramonica echoed a similar sentiment. The acerbic and unrelentingly sad Unreal doesn't exist just to send up reality television or to pick at its scabs, he said. Rather, Unreal uses that access as a tool to ask questions about these sorts of programs, not just about how they operate, savagely, if its stories are to be believed, but also why participants on both sides of the camera subject themselves to them. I reached out to Shapiro numerous times for an interview for this book, but she never responded. I heard through the grapevine that she's done talking about The Bachelor. Alas, when I interviewed her for the LA Times prior to Unreal's debut in 2015, it was clear that her time on The Batch was anything but positive. A native of Santa Barbara, where her father taught at the nearby UCSB, Shapiro began dreaming of a directing career when she was a teenager. She went to college at Sarah Lawrence, where she hoped to study under the poet Mary Oliver. She was rejected from the poet's workshop, but went on to major in fiction writing and filmmaking. During her senior year, she began interning for indie film powerhouse Christine Vachon, and later got a job managing the studio of fashion photographer David LaChapelle. At age 22, she migrated from New York to Los Angeles in the hopes of pursuing her directing dream. Instead, she landed on one of Fleiss's shows, High School Reunion. While there, she said, she signed some sort of contract that committed her to unlimited renewable options for perpetuity, meaning she was obligated to work on other Next Entertainment productions, too. When she was asked to start on The Bachelor, though, she was horrified. "I said, oh my God, I'm a feminist," she recalled, describing her horror at the proposition. "It was like the apocalypse to me, like the worst thing that had ever happened. It was like asking a vegan activist to work in a slaughterhouse." Still, she went, and under Levinson, she climbed the ranks from associate producer to field producer, where she was responsible for coming up with romantic dates and storylines. She told me that she didn't remember all the seasons she worked on during her three-year tenure with the show, but she was certain she was around for Andrew Firestone's and Bob Guinea's. After a few years, she was miserable, but she was such a good Jewish kid that I could not make myself get fired. Instead, she told her boss she was going to kill herself if she didn't leave. It was 2005, and she put all her stuff into her car, drove to Portland, Oregon, and considered becoming a kale farmer. "I was so damaged," she said. "I couldn't be near recording devices or talk on the phone for months." So what did she witness that was so traumatizing? Mainly, she said, it was realizing that what was happening on the show was having a real-life impact on the contestants. She wondered whether the participants were aware of what they were signing up for, because truly, they can't know what they're signing up for. You can't really understand the power of editing, and there are a lot of really smart people making these shows. It's a chess game you can't win. During her time on the show, she kept thinking back to her days in college, sitting in feminist seminars that would pose the question, how much would it cost you to sell your soul? She'd always thought the answer would be millions of dollars, but at The Bachelor, she realized it was just a fucking paycheck. After 18 years of your parents building your morality, the desperation of staying alive sinks in so quickly. Michael Carroll, who became one of Shapiro's closest friends at the show, said everyone knew how unhappy she was. She was a smart New York chick who was constantly complaining. Why am I doing this? I'm a feminist and I hate this shit. So why didn't Carroll have a problem with the job? I'm from Jacksonville, Florida. I didn't grow up in a feminist environment, he said with a shrug. But Sarah was a Jewish New York girl who went to a great college and wanted to do things and wanted to make films. And she was a big schlub, like one of those like East Village girls. Dirty t-shirt, hair in a fucking ponytail, hated everything, jeans showing her fucking butt crack, fucking dirty tennis shoes. She was always grumpy. There were, of course, moments on The Bachelor that Shapiro enjoyed. She admitted that she wasn't immune to the princess fantasy the show was selling, and even got a thrill out of eyeing the pricey diamond rings that were used during the proposals. Diamonds can hypnotize anyone, she said. Sometimes I'd have to transport them to the show, and I politically don't believe in diamonds. I think that whole thing is bullshit. I know it's not right. And I still would get weird around diamonds, trying them on with my dirty baggy jeans and down jacket. That idea that some girls are pretty, pretty princesses that deserve to be taken care of and rescued and saved and cared for, that sets us up for a lot of heartbreak. To Shapiro's mind, so much of the appeal of The Bachelor is related to its sentimentality, that the show creates a world where everyone knows what their role is. The guy is chivalrous, and the girl is a princess. To be a perfect contestant, you should be a lawyer that gives really awesome blowjobs and doesn't really care about being a lawyer, she said with a laugh. Like, I just passed the bar for fun. You're really professionally successful, demure, and submissive. Sexy, but not slutty. And yet with Unreal, Shapiro's intention wasn't to pass judgment on fans of the franchise. Our aim was to have compassion for why we fall into these fantasies, she explained. I'm not above it. I love being wooed, and I totally want someone to get me a helicopter ride. Who doesn't? It wasn't long before those in Bachelor Nation started responding to the show. While many former contestants were quick to say they related to Unreal, and recognized numerous producing tactics portrayed on it, others were displeased with the depiction. Chris Harrison, for one, was decidedly not a fan, saying the main difference between the fictional show and the reality show was that people watch The Bachelor. Ooh, a sick ratings burn. It's complete fiction, he went on to say in an interview with Variety. As much as they would love to jump on our coattails, they were begging for us to talk about it and for people to write about it. At the end of the day, no one is watching. I mean, absolutely nobody is watching that show. Why? It is terrible. It is really terrible. Lifetime will air the third season of Unreal in 2018, so obviously someone is watching. In any event, it certainly rattled plenty of people affiliated with the show. Even Scott Jeffress, who worked with Shapiro during the early days of The Bachelor. It's a little frustrating for me. They're kind of lifting the skirt and showing behind the scenes, Jeffress said. I don't have any animosity about it, but it's a shame for our industry that this has to happen, that we have to tell those tales. It bothers me a little bit that it kind of softens what the viewer is seeing. It was inevitable it was going to happen, and God bless Shapiro that she's the one who did it. She'll make money for it. But it kind of blows the cover on the whole Bachelor thing. Yes, Unreal did raise questions about the way in which reality producers manipulate contestants and just how ethical it may or may not be to do so. But I think it also started to force fans to examine the way we consume the show. Right around the time the program began airing, I started noticing a glut of similarly themed essays popping up on female-centric publications. Elle, 9 Reasons Strong, Intelligent, Feminist Women Watch The Bachelor. HuffPost, The Bachelor, Why Smart Women Watch and Love It. The Washington Post, 10 Times The Bachelor Shows Made Feminists Proud. The Guardian, Does Binging on The Bachelor Make Me a Bad Feminist? Vogue, Why Feminists Are Unabashedly Obsessed with The Bachelor. This was obviously a topic female viewers were struggling with. Something about loving The Bachelor made many women feel ashamed, like they were in some way betraying their gender. So I returned to feminist scholar Andy Zeisler to get her thoughts on the flood of think pieces exploring the connection between the show and feminism. It almost seems to be less about The Bachelor and more about this idea in the past few years that if you identify as a feminist, you have to somehow justify everything that you consume, Zeisler theorized. Every piece of pop culture or media, you have to kind of justify watching it as a feminist act, which I find a little bit ass-backward. But people really feel like their consumption patterns have to be explained as part of a larger identity. After reading some of the essays just mentioned, Zeisler told me she felt like women were twisting themselves into pretzels to explain why watching the show was actually a feminist act. To her mind, none of the arguments were convincing. And that's okay. Establishing feminism as a purity test is just a losing proposition because we do things all the time in our daily lives that contradict a feminist worldview, she said. It could be as simple as being married or shopping at Target. There's kind of no way to win once you start thinking about it like that. If you're actively working toward feminism, watching The Bachelor or shopping at Target or wearing leather shoes or whatever, that's not going to cancel out that part of your life. When she starts seeing men writing tortured essays about how watching Sunday Night Football is really shaking their faith in themselves as left-leaning progressives, that's when, she joked, she'll give these feminist arguments more credence. But Susan Douglas, the U Michigan communications professor who authored Enlightened Sexism, The Seductive Message That Feminism's Work Is Done, told me she understood why so many women were troubled by their fandom. Young women in the 21st century who are college educated and have managerial positions, in other words, the main bachelor demographic, have been told for years that they can do anything they want. And yet these same women still face pressure to be thin, beautiful, and stylish. They're pinioned between wanting the fruits of feminism without sacrificing the femininity that's going to help them advance, not just in relationships, but at work, Douglas said. So on the one hand, you're like, oh my God, this is the dumbest show ever. The dates are stupid. It is reinforcing the most retrograde standards around female beauty and performance. In the other ear, it is a tale of courtship and romance in this age of how do you even meet men? The show, she argued, also appeals to women on a more basic level. Let's say you're watching the nightly news. Will Donald Trump's economic policy really produce deficits? Who knows? Here on The Bachelor, you can be a completely authoritative judge about which kinds of women are performing a kind of womanhood you, as a woman, admire, and that you think men might admire. Sometimes The Bachelor does show that a man and a woman with their own careers can fall in love, and she doesn't have to give up the world for him. And what's so bad about that? Douglas said. On the other hand, it's historically been very white, it's very heteronormative, it's very, very middle class, and all of the women have to be a size zero, look great in a bikini, and be very conventionally pretty. So there are very narrow corporate standards of thinness and beauty, stereotypes of female behavior that the show incessantly reinforces. That, of course, is what's troubling to feminists about watching The Bachelor. But like Zeisler, Douglas agrees that just because you watch the show, it doesn't mean, for example, that you wouldn't support equal pay for women, go to bat for Planned Parenthood, or condemn sexual harassment. The fact that these discussions are happening within Bachelor Nation is a relatively new phenomenon, fueled largely by fan engagement on social media. According to Twitter, The Bachelor was one of the top five most tweeted about reality shows on TV in the United States between 2015 and July 2017. On average, the tech company said, The Bachelor gets roughly 260,000 tweets per episode. The Bachelorette generates about 180,000. There are also about a dozen prominent podcasts about the franchise, where fans not only recap weekly episodes, but dive into the social dynamics at play on the program. The Ringer's Juliet Littman hosts Bachelorette Party, Bustle has Will You Accept This Podcast, and HuffPost is behind Here to Make Friends. In the past year, even Batch alums have gotten in on the podcast game, with Caitlin Bristow, Ben Higgins, Ashley Iaconetti, Becca Tilley, Dean Unglert, and Olivia Caridi all offering up their insights on the franchise. I think pop culture has really started to engage with the show because it has a universally appealing premise, said Emma Gray, who co-hosts Here to Make Friends with her HuffPost colleague Claire Fallon. It taps into these really basic notions of love and weirdness around sex and dating and fulfillment. And then Twitter popped up at the right time, making it so everyone wanted to watch live and go on Twitter and make fun of it so they could be in on the conversation in real time. They've created this loop where people feel like they need to be a part of this community online in order to watch it. Young women are the primary demographic for Gray's show, which goes up once a week while The Bachelor is on the air. Roughly 50,000 listeners tune in to each podcast, she said. Even Reality Steve has a Bachelor podcast now. Reality Steve, whose real name, sadly, is not Reality Steve, is Steve Carbone, a 42-year-old blogger who lives in Dallas, Texas. And to ABC's dismay, his moniker has become synonymous with the Bachelor franchise. For the better part of a decade, Carbone has made a living reporting spoilers about The Bachelor, which wasn't his intention when he started recapping television shows in 2003, sharing his thoughts on Joe Millionaire with a list of email subscribers. When that show came to a close, his followers asked if he had plans to recap any other shows, and the next dating program on the television schedule was The Bachelorette. At the time, writing was just Carbone's hobby. He did it for fun and was hopeful that someday a professional TV site might hire him to do some freelance work. But in 2009, everything changed. A tipster contacted him with this note. Hey, I know you write about the show and you've got a following. Well, I found something out about the ending of this season of The Bachelor. The season currently on the air was Jason Mesnick's, and the ending of that season went down in the Batch history books when Mesnick, infamously, spurned fiancé Melissa Rycroft on the After the Final Rose special and told her he was still in love with his runner-up, Molly Mullaney. Carbone's source had the dirt before the special aired, and based on who it was and what they knew, I was like, okay, this is legit, the blogger recalled. So he ran with it, publishing the information on his site roughly 2 weeks before the finale aired. There were doubters, of course, but when the prediction turned out to be true, Carbone instantly became the Bachelor authority. Suddenly, anonymous sources started turning up left and right, willing to give him dirt on the show. Carbone said his sources vary every season, and when one begins anew, he has no idea where his information will be coming from. By now, though, he said he's confident good scoops will come his way. It's just a matter of how detailed and when. It's become easier now because of the popularity of the site, Carbone explained. I don't need to solicit anything anymore. So how does he tell good tips from the bad ones? The best example I can give, he said, is if I get an email that's one sentence long, misspelled, and has no punctuation saying, I know who wins, it's like, okay, but how do you know? When they tell me how they know, that's when I know if it's legit or not. If someone says they're a friend or a cousin of the contestant in question, Carbone's ears perk up. People on the show often spill to those around them, even though they're not supposed to. Once he has a tip, he'll follow up by doing some good old-fashioned social media stalking, tracking down biographical details, double-checking locations, and digging up photos to piece everything together. The show has also gotten more lax about filming in public. Early dates often take place in very visible settings, and oftentimes fans are invited to witness the dates. They're not supposed to say what they see during filming, but they do. And within hours, Carbone's inbox is flooded with pictures, tweets, and Instagram postings. Sometimes, all he has to do is a quick search of the word bachelor or bachelorette on Instagram, and information he wasn't expecting will pop up. Even if it's stuff from early on in the season, it helps Carbone to narrow down the field. And what exactly are these anonymous sources getting out of sharing information with Carbone? Zip. And nada. Zilch. I think people just like feeling they're part of it, Carbone surmised. He certainly can't pay his sources. He tried that once and almost got into some serious legal trouble. During Ben Flanick's time as a bachelor, Carbone attempted to contact three women who had competed on the 2012 season, searching for information about Flanick's final pick. Two of the women responded, but told Carbone they couldn't help him for fear they'd get in trouble if they did. That's when he offered to pay the ladies in exchange for information, but they both declined. Just a few weeks later, Carbone received an email from a lawyer at Warner Brothers, alerting him to the fact that the company was aware of his exchanges with the female contestants. It wasn't long before he was served with a lawsuit on his doorstep. ABC had their smoking gun of, oh shit, this guy is now offering our contestants money and sooner or later someone's going to take it because we don't pay them, Carbone said. If they can make money on the side by doing this, they're going to take it, so that's probably why they didn't want me doing that anymore, is my guess. Eventually, Carbone reached a settlement with the show, the gist of which reads, stay away from our contestants, he said. Essentially, he's chilled out on soliciting information, but no one can stop him from publishing information that comes to him. While he had to pay his own legal fees, he was not required to pay anything to anyone involved with the show, Carbone said. To this day, he has never had any interaction with Mike Fleiss or any of the producers, only the legal team at Warner Brothers. It was a little bit empowering to know that they were really bothered by me, he said, a hint of pride in his voice. But I've never done the spoilers so people won't watch. I've done them so they'll watch the show differently. You can see storylines, you can see editing. Indeed, Carbone's spoilers don't seem to have had any major impact on the show's ratings. Since the couple at the end almost always breaks up anyway, knowing who ends up together isn't that big of a deal. In the meantime, Carbone is able to make a living off his site. He started putting up advertisements in 2010, and he was able to make the blog his full-time job by August 2011. Roughly 65% of his traffic comes from mobile devices, which isn't great since desktop ads are more lucrative than mobile ones. Still, his traffic is strong. When any one of the Bachelor shows is on, he said he gets between 6 to 8 million page views a month. Off-season, that number drops precipitously to around 2 million per month. It might seem like easy work, he said, but it's all-consuming. I'm almost like a doctor in that I'm constantly on call, he said. At any point during the day, I can get an email, a text, a direct message, an Instagram message, a Snapchat message, something that says, hey, here's what I've heard. You might want to look into this. My phone is my job. With outsiders trying to capitalize on the lucrative Bachelor market, it only makes sense that Warner Brothers, which produces the show, would do the same. In 2016, the company announced its consumer products line would start releasing the Bachelor Wines, a collection of wines inspired by the award-winning television series, according to a press release. The line offers three varietals. There's the Fantasy Suite, a Cabernet Sauvignon, the One-on-One, a Chardonnay, and the Final Rosé, a Zinfandel and Petit Sirah blend. The wines are manufactured by winemakers in California's Central Coast and Central Valley and retail for $16.96 a bottle. You probably won't be surprised to learn that I purchased all three bottles for my batch discuss group to sample, and let me tell you, they were not a hit. Iconetti brought an extra bottle of the Fantasy Suite 1 week. I hope one she was gifted for free. And 1 year later, I still have it. I put that damn bottle of wine out on the table every single week. No one wants to drink that shit. Bachelor Candy, on the other hand, that went more quickly. In 2016, Sugarfina created an official collaboration with ABC called the Will You Accept This Rose Bento Box. It was filled with the final rose and the first impression rose made with the Whispering Angel Rosé. Our core demographic is young women, kind of that 18 to late 30s age range. They are also a big fan of The Bachelor, so from an audience perspective, it was just perfectly aligned, Rosie O'Neill, Sugarfina's founder, told me. This is a young woman who loves to post on social media, loves to have something new and fresh and cute to share on her feed, and the candies are so cute and they connect directly with The Bachelor. So we think during the viewing season that people will get excited about it and have something cute to post. In a way, watching The Bachelor has become a badge of honor, as something that was once considered gauche now carries an odd sense of cultural cachet. Huge celebrities like Jennifer Aniston, Sean Penn, and John Mayer go on talk shows hosted by Jimmy Kimmel and Ellen DeGeneres and spend their entire interview segments discussing their love of The Bachelor. Even the snarky Howard Stern admits he's a fan and sometimes spends large portions of his SiriusXM radio show talking about it, though he's often just complaining about the vocal fry the female contestants speak with. Still, even though many high-profile stars now openly discuss their love of The Bachelor, there's always a hint of irony that comes along with the admission. Like, yes, I love this show, but I don't really love it. I just love to make fun of it. It's a train wreck! And after spending all this time reporting on the show, I have to say, I think that's bullshit. I think we watch The Bachelor because we're anxious about our own love lives, and the show gives us an outlet to express our fears about the modern dating world. It allows us to see a world filled with courtship, chivalry, and romance. And while we may scoff at the helicopters and hot tubs, deep down, I think many of us still long for those kind of things while we're spending hours swiping left on Tinder. Helen Fisher, the cultural anthropologist, thinks the show serves as a modern-day campfire of sorts, allowing us to discuss mating rituals in a communal setting, even if that community is Twitter. For millions of years, we lived in these little hunting and gathering bands. We sat around the fire at night, gossiping about who did what to whom, and, oh, she was mean to him, so he's leaving her, and, oh, I would have done it differently, Fisher said. In other words, they were getting dating tips. They were sharing these experiences of watching other people around them and other people's romantic lives. We've been doing this forever. But now, we're also sharing an experience in a society where we don't know much about each other. Love, of course, is something we've all experienced, but not in the way The Bachelor depicts it. And that's why Scott Jeffress, the executive producer from the show's early days, thinks it fills a certain void for us. It gives us hope that a frothy, beautiful love story is just out of reach. The Bachelor was the perfect thing after 9/11, he said. Disaster movies were down at the box office. People did not want to be depressed or sad. They wanted to have a fantasy. They wanted to imagine what could be and be happy. I truly think that's why The Bachelor hit at the perfect time. Sure. Maybe that's the purpose The Bachelor served initially, before we knew that every couple coming out of the show stood little chance of actually making it to the altar. Beyond the inevitable breakups, how are we supposed to buy into the fantasy when we now understand so much about how the sausage is made? There are so many things that taint the illusion. The contestants who now go on the show to become social media influencers. The bubble effect that convinces the cast they're head over heels with the bachelor or bachelorette. The producers who masterfully persuade participants to drop the album and get down on one knee. The editing that makes everything seem far more dramatic than it actually was. The life-altering effect the experience can have on individuals' reputations and careers after their 15 minutes fade away. How do we watch The Bachelor now, knowing what we know? This is something I've spent a lot of time thinking about in the course of writing this book. Now, more than ever, I understand how incredibly problematic the show can be. And yet, first and foremost, I'm a fan. When I'm sitting in front of my television every Monday, surrounded by a group of my best friends, there's no place I'd rather be. And should that make me feel bad? Even if I'm watching the show with a critical eye, just by turning it on every week and giving ABC ratings, aren't I propagating some of the very things I find so troublesome to see? Perhaps. But I actually don't think these issues would be solved if we all just stopped watching. There are bigger, more fundamental questions that we need to be grappling with. Why are so many of us desperate for the type of fame that television can bring? Why is it so easy and so fun to judge others from the privacy of our own homes? And why do so many of us depend on romantic love to validate our worth? Frankly, these are all ideas I'm still contending with in my own life, especially when it comes to marriage. At 32, I've now lived in Los Angeles for more than a decade. I moved across the country at 18 and managed to form a life of my own. I have a great group of friends, many of whom dutifully show up at my home each week with veggie platters and tortilla chips just to watch reality TV with me. I have a fun career that I'm proud of. Joan Rivers once told me I was a smart cookie. And I have a dog who's really fucking cute. And yet, I'd be lying if I said I didn't feel like somewhat of a failure of a woman because I haven't found a man to spend my life with. And sometimes those very feelings are exacerbated by watching The Bachelor. Those sad women who leave in the limos, questioning why they're not good enough to attract a special man, I've been that woman, on many a Saturday night, in fact. So many critics are quick to say The Bachelor has screwed up an entire generation of women, created unrealistic expectations for so many of us who will never get to fly in a helicopter or wear a $100,000 ring on our finger. But I would argue that that kind of hope isn't entirely damaging. More often than not, somehow the show manages to make me feel good about still being single. I watch men being so open and communicative with their emotions, and I'm reminded of why I'm waiting for the kind of man who will be that way with me. I watch how fun and exciting it can be to fall in love and remember how good those feelings are, how they're worth fighting for, and how the instant they overtake you, the lonely Saturday nights quickly fade from memory. So, yes, I will continue to watch The Bachelor. I'm hopeful that the show will continue to evolve, tweaking its tried and true formulas so that the contrast between the supposed fairy tale unfolding on screen and the reality of dating off camera isn't quite so stark. But in the meantime, I'll be planted in front of my TV, watching alongside a group of women as we all try to understand the inscrutable, wicked, brilliant thing that is love. This is Amy Kaufman. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Bachelor Nation, Inside the World of America's Guilty Pleasure. This program was directed by Scott Sherritt, executive producer Diane McKiernan. Text copyright 2018 by Amy Kaufman. Production copyright 2018, Penguin Random House, LLC. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.